This episode is brought to you by Envision Studio, the world's most powerful screen design tool. Unlock new dimensions of screen design with Envision Studio's adaptive layout engine, rapid prototyping, advanced animation, shared design systems, and more. Visit userdefenders.com/studio to get early access.
And so I'm a big believer in the idea that when we design things intentionally to be more inclusive, we are making them better for everyone to begin with.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 51. This is the last episode of season 4, and I couldn't be more proud to end this amazing season with the content contained in this episode. Derek Featherstone is the pure definition of a design superhero. He does everything in his power to not leave any user behind, especially those with disabilities. Today's episode is all about designing for accessibility and inclusivity, although I think I said inclusivity during the interview. It's shorter than usual, but is jam-packed with design inspiration for this seemingly more seldom talked about topic. I hope you truly enjoy and are inspired, perhaps even more, to craft experiences where all are welcomed and all are served. And while we're talking about serving, let me serve up the latest iTunes review that came through. This is from Andy Shads, and this person said, "A truly inspiring podcast. 5 stars. Truly inspiring and an absolute gold nugget in terms of design podcast. Jason and his guests have motivated me to take and complete a course in UX and continue to learn more about this amazing field. There's always great practical takeaways from each episode, and they perfectly combine entertaining with educational." Wow. Thank you so much for leaving that amazing review, Andy Shads. I am so glad to hear that this podcast has motivated you to take and complete a course in UX and continue to learn more. That's incredible. And that's really what this is all about, is to try to inspire you, inspire and equip the next generation of design superheroes. And you are one of them, my friend. So keep on fighting on, and let me and the community know how we can serve you on your important design journey. Defenders listening, would you do what Andy Shads did and take a few moments of your valuable time to leave a rating and review on iTunes? I can't tell you how much the show benefits from that, especially because I don't advertise. And there are lots of other designers in the world who are starting their journey and trying to stay inspired and equipped to navigate this field, ever-evolving and complex, as I always say. So I would be grateful if you could go to userdefenders.com/review or just search UX in iTunes. I think it'll come up pretty close to the top there. Thanks to you and your reviews. So thank you in advance. Derek Featherstone is an internationally known speaker and authority on accessibility and inclusive design. He's been working on the web since 1999, starting out as a web developer. He migrated to the field of accessibility and quickly discovered the need to move thinking about accessibility and inclusion into the design process. He founded and led an international team of accessibility and usability experts at Simply Accessible, which was recently acquired by Level Access, where Derek is now the Chief Experience Officer, focusing on ensuring that accessibility and inclusion are seen as an integral part of user experience and service design, rather than as a simple checklist afterthought. Derek lives in Ottawa, Canada, with his wife and their 4 children. He's also a fitness instructor and 3-time Ironman triathlon finisher. Derek, welcome to User Defenders. I am super excited to have you on the show today.
I am super excited to be here. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So the Ironman, I can tell you, Derek, that the only Ironman I finished is the one starring Robert Downey Jr. So can you talk about that for a minute? I mean, that's a lot of training, right? The Ironman stuff.
It is. It's more training than I expected. Now, having said that, I haven't been doing any Ironman training recently. This was, you know, things that I did between around 2007 and 2010, 2011. So I'm actually looking forward to getting back into it. But it's not something that I've been able to do recently. But it's way more than I thought it was going to be at the time, to the point where I think peak training time, we were training about, you know, somewhere between 15 and 17 hours a week between the pool, open water swimming, biking and running. With those three things, we were probably training about 15 to 17 hours a week.
So I bet you some of that tenacity in your training has spilled over into what you do for accessibility and design and things like that. So I'm really excited to learn more about how that ties into your discipline, what you're doing today and what you've been doing for, frankly, for quite a long time. So every superhero, and you are a superhero, Derek, has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Sure. So I have a disability myself. I don't consider it to be a major disability or anything like that. It's something that I've never let stop me do anything. And I was born with a club foot, which means that my left leg was facing straight, but my left foot was basically pointing and hooked in towards my right foot.
Wow.
And so, you know, I had surgery when I was 3 years old. I used to have to wear these shoes that turned my feet out and had a metal bar between them so that I, you know, it was kind of to try and get my foot pointing outwards since it was naturally kind of hooked inwards. And that's something I remember my dad telling me stories about. The doctor said, well, you know, you shouldn't expect him to be too active or anything like that. But I just didn't really listen to that part, I guess. Mm. I was, you know, pulling myself up in my crib and still happy as could be and didn't really know any different because it, you know, just, so I've got this set of shoes on with a bar in it, you know, no big deal. So, you know, of course I wasn't consciously thinking that, but I didn't really know any different at the time. So I grew up with that. But I don't think that it didn't have much impact on me from a disability perspective, but it's certainly, I never let it get in the way of me doing any of the things that I wanted to do. And so I was pretty active as a kid. I played all kinds of sports, basketball, rugby, volleyball, soccer, football, you know, as many things as I could, fastball, all of them. And so I really never let it get in my way and just kind of did whatever I wanted to anyway. But my left leg is weaker, and I'm certainly finding now as I'm getting older that it's, you know, I'm a little bit less active now and therefore my left leg is, I'm finding I notice it a little bit more now. It's definitely a smaller size than my right leg and it's definitely weaker than the other, but that's, I think, part of kind of my foundation of growing up and who I am. So I had, you know, a lot of different experiences growing up. I used to be a high school teacher and I was very much into multiple intelligence theory, which, you know, lots of people don't really agree with or sort of challenge as a valid theory.
What is it?
But multiple intelligence theory, at its core is this idea that we have different ways of knowing things and different types of intelligence. And so you will often hear people say things like, oh, she's a really hands-on learner, or he's a visual learner, or whatever it is. And so that really is speaking more to their learning styles and the way that things connect with them and the way that people are able to make sense of those things. So multiple intelligence is really kind of this idea that we all have varying degrees of intelligences in different ways. Ultimately, what I was really trying to do with that when I was teaching high school was really finding ways to connect what I was teaching with all of my students, regardless of the type of learning style or the learning modalities that they preferred. And so it was really about the message and the lessons being important for everybody and not just people that were, you know, I was a biology and chemistry teacher. So I taught biology, chemistry, and computers. And my goal was that those things didn't just matter or make sense to those people that were very mathematically or logically inclined or scientifically minded from the beginning. I was trying to do things that really connected with people that were really interested in the arts. And so I would do things where I would encourage people to write poetry about the science concepts that they had learned and things like that, so that it helped connect for them. So in many ways, you know, it's really about that message being for everyone and that those lessons being for everybody. When I started doing stuff on the web, accessibility just kind of made sense. This content, this stuff that we're doing, this functionality, whatever it is, really is for everybody, not just for people that are using a particular browser or aren't using assistive technologies or have full use of their senses or whatever. So it was really a thing for me that made a whole lot of sense when I started exploring the accessibility world. And the rest is kind of like, that's what drew me into it. And then it became something that I just, for whatever reason, really became passionate about. It was something that I saw as really important. And I had lived with my grandparents in my teens for some of the, you know, for summers, because I was working, and I where they lived was closer to where I was working. So I lived with them, and my grandfather in the mid 1980s had a stroke, and living with him, I was helping him all the time with things. And I saw some of the struggles that he had with accessibility in the physical world, you know, tripping over curbs and things like that, because there wasn't a good, easy ramp for him to walk up and things like that. So for me, there's a whole lot of stuff that kind of all came in at the same time that, or, you know, all these different thoughts that I think contributed to me naturally gravitating towards accessibility. So there's a whole lot there, I think, that goes into it. And it's really this composite picture of all these experiences that I had that I think have led me to where I am today.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, this show is superhero themed, as you know, and it's just really, it's interesting to look into your backstory and even just the little that you've told us so far about, you know, kind of where you came from. And I think about, you know, your foot, it was a club foot. Is that what you called it?
Yeah.
Club.
Yeah.
I think about that. And I think about the experience helping your grandfather and just kind of trying to put yourself in his shoes. And I feel like there's so many superheroes that have some sort of condition or ailment that by every account should actually hold them back from their full potential. Yet they actually use that as a superpower. They turn it into a superpower and to help others. And I just feel like that's your backstory already, Derek, is just showing me a lot of parallels with actual superheroes. And I love that. Can you go into some more things that maybe just were aha moments for you on this journey of kind of, you know, putting yourself in other people's shoes, especially the seemingly and unfortunately largely forgotten disabled population that are using technology?
Sure. I know one of the things that was a moment for me was pretty early on in my career. We were doing some work, and we were doing accessibility specific work, and there were times where people were coming to us for technical advice, and we always recommended, yes, we can give you the technical advice on how to implement things, and that's a great starting point, but it can't be the ending point. And ultimately we said, we need to do some work after you've fixed all the things that we've showed you. We want you to put this to the test with real people, and let's test this with people with disabilities in a usability type session, rather than just relying on us giving technical advice and going to fix all of those things. Let's put this to the test with real people that use assistive technologies every day because they rely on it, because they need it. And there's a whole lot of moments where we would go to a person's house or their apartment, and we would be sitting there with them and doing usability testing and having people try to complete tasks that we knew could technically be done. But seeing and hearing their reactions when seeing somebody use a system that we had helped become more accessible, and seeing a person try to get through filling out the form with an on-screen keyboard where he was typing, you know, using that on-screen keyboard, he was typing one character every, you know, every 3 to 5 seconds and seeing a form time out because there was just way too much stuff there, or seeing those moments where we get partway through a process or we were partway through the process and we get, you know, say 2/3 of the way through. And then he's suddenly prompted for something that we really should have prompted him for at the beginning of the process. For me, if you tell me that I need my driver's license at the beginning of a process, I'm going to go and get it. I'll have it handy and I'll have it ready. If you don't tell me at the beginning and I need it 2/3 of the way through, it probably takes me 30 seconds to a minute to go get it and continue where I'm from. Where this gentleman needed his identification to be able to proceed. And it took him like 10 minutes almost to be able to not only find it, because he didn't need it very often, but not only find it, but to be able to, you know, work his way around his apartment to get to where he was, to work around his workstation where he was sitting, where he was set up with all of his assistive technology, having to stop and having to go and get that and bring it back and then continue. The impact on him of not having that stuff available up front was just way more impactful than it was or would have been on me, because I could have been able to get my stuff, my identification really quickly. And so moments like that where you just realize, you know, you pass these things off as, well, that's a little inconvenience. There's all kinds of moments where that little inconvenience to me as a person without a disability really becomes significant for someone that does. And those kinds of moments are just, I don't want to say they're mind-blowing, but they're more like those, as you said, it's like those aha moments where the light bulb goes off and you realize I've really missed something big here and I should have done this differently. You know, we should have made this design. We all know that we should give people the requirements up front before they're about to go and fill out a form, but It really drives home the impact of not doing so when we do usability testing with people with different disabilities.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm just kind of thinking about this right now, this whole thing. I think it was Eric Meyer who said, when we say edge case, we really just define the boundaries of what we care about. And I feel like so often, and I am totally guilty, I'll raise my hand, you know, of just kind of forgetting about a lot of these folks that are just, they're not us. I mean, they're complete opposite from us. And I know you just described a scenario, just one, where you observed a fellow trying to type and he was not able to do it. I mean, it took him 10 minutes to type maybe a sentence, right? Like, I mean, that's one of those eye-opening things where we just, you know, like the edge cases, I feel like this is really the core of edge case, if you think about it. And why do we tend to forget, you know, about these folks so often when we're designing experiences?
I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that, because I think,
okay,
you know, you said they're, you know, these people aren't like us. I would actually say these people are exactly like us. They just use different tools. They use different tools, or they have, you know, maybe they don't go as fast as us, but there's a whole lot about people with disabilities that is exactly the same. You know, usually their motivations, their goals, the things that they're trying to achieve on any site, they're going to be exactly the same as us. And so I would say they're more similar or more the same than they are different. And so I would challenge that notion that they're different. It's just that their method of execution is different, or the tools that they use are different. We did a, you know, usability session yesterday with a client, and we were just kind of doing a walkthrough and stuff. And the young lady that we were working with, I asked her about her assistive technology. She's paraplegic, and she was using Dragon Naturally Speaking to use voice recognition for everything that she does on her computer. And she's, you know, quite good at it. There's some things that kind of slow her down at times. But I asked her, what other assistive technologies, if any, do you use? And her response was brilliant. She said, yeah, my Amazon Echo. And she said, I use it. She's paraplegic, so it's difficult for her to get around her house or her apartment. She said, I use the Amazon Echo to be able to turn on and off my lights easily. I use it to unlock and open my front door when my caregiver arrives. And her whole perspective, this tool, you know, I look, you know, the Amazon Echo for me, it's totally a convenience tool. But for her, as somebody that relies on a voice user interface, it's actually now a core piece of her assistive technology. She's just using a different tool to do the same thing. Instead of her walking and opening the door by hand, she's getting Alexa to do it for her. And instead of walking over and flipping on the light switch or flipping off the light switch, she's getting Alexa to do it for her. So the things that she's trying to do in her day-to-day life are exactly the same. She's just using a different set of tools to get it done.
Thank you for correcting my framing on that, Derek. And this is kind of an example of me just not understanding, like, and me not being in the same environment as disabled folks who are doing their best with the tools they have. So I appreciate that, man. And you're right. They aren't different. They just use different tools to navigate. And, you know, and speaking of which, can you go into, because this is completely like, I'm a guy asking questions to you, Derek, as somebody who's, I think in a lot of ways, representing the defenders listening to, who are especially just kind of diving into this field. And I've been at this for a long time, and there's still a ton I don't know about, you know, how disabled folks navigate a website or how they use a mobile app. Or can you shed light for us, like what kind of tools, like different disabilities and what kind of tools that maybe these folks use, and what some of the challenges, inherent challenges with some of these tools?
Sure. There's a full range, and there's pretty much everything you could possibly think about. And I'll say this to you first as well. You've been at this for a long time, and there's all kinds of stuff that you don't know because you're not immersed in it every day. For the most part, immersed in it every day, and I've been at this for a long time, and I still learn new things every day, right? Like that's the reality that we have. I mean, I know a lot of things, but there's new little nuances and insights that I gain from working with people with disabilities and understanding the tools that they use in a more detailed way, and understanding how do we make this better, that comes from all of these insights. And so for me, that's part of the reason I love it, is because I'm constantly learning new things as well. And I love that about this field. I think it's kind of, that's part of why I've always thought and felt that accessibility is just part of user experience. It's not a fixed thing, like this is how things work for somebody that is blind, and therefore we know how to fix all of the problems. It's not a set black and white thing. There's new things coming up all the time, new technologies. I really think it's a big part of overall user experience. Like, it's not just about the tools. It's about people trying to get stuff done that happen to be using tools. So there's, I would say broadly, about four or five different categories of different disabilities. And they're pretty wide ranging. So I would say, you know, two people that have low vision, for example, may have completely different needs. We might have two people that are on the autism spectrum that there's no comparison between them because they have completely different needs and characteristics between them. So we generally talk about visual impairment, hearing impairment, mobility or dexterity impairment, and then things that kind of fall into the realm of neurodiversity. And those might be things like literacy-related issues or attention-related issues, numeracy-related issues, the need for predictability and consistency in an interface. We all need consistency and predictability in an interface, but someone that is on the autism spectrum, that person that's autistic might actually need that predictability in order to be able to move forward. Whereas it's a small pain for us to have this unpredictable interface where things change from one screen to the next. But for someone that's autistic, they might require it. Mm. And so there's all kinds of, you know, and I would say this, anything on the cognitive and the neurodiversity side, that's kind of the least well-known area of accessibility. So that's a big research area that people are putting a lot of time into these days, is figuring out what can we do that focuses on the cognitive side, that focuses on the neurodiversity side. You know, there's things that are new techniques and new technologies are always being built. I would say probably up until about 5 or 6 years ago, people didn't really ever talk about things like vestibular disorders or vestibular type issues. There's growing kind of groundswell behind, and it's not even necessarily groundswell. It's not like it's a movement, but it's a better understanding of what is happening. So in vestibular related issues, your vestibular system is like your inner ear, and it contributes a lot to your balance. And one of the things that we've started to find is that people with vestibular related issues, when they're looking at animations on a web page and we've got parallax type effects, so you know that feeling of vertigo that you get when you're standing at the base of a tall building and you look up and you're like, whoa, this, you know, I'm not feeling too good. The building starts to wobble and that sort of thing to various degrees.
All of a sudden you're a star in Inception.
Exactly. And so for some people with different types of vestibular related conditions, that's what their entire life is like, looking at a screen that's doing animations. It can cause dizziness. It can even be more severe. It can cause headaches and migraines, nausea, things like that. So that's something that we didn't really hear about until about 5 or 6 years ago. And people are becoming much more aware of it, to the point where Apple built into the iOS a preference for you to basically say it's a reduced motion setting, so that all those animations and fun interfaces that we think we're creating, since they can actually cause significant pain or discomfort for people with vestibular related issues, they actually have the ability to go in and turn that setting off, so that instead of animating, the effects in the interface are done in a different way. So instead of an animated page turn, it might be a fade or something like that, where there's no animation that's going to trigger dizziness or nausea or things like that. So
yeah, or maybe a seizure even.
Potentially, yeah. So these kinds of things are changing all the time, and we're learning more about them. I kind of love that. So when we talk about the cognitive or the neurodiversity side of things, things are changing, and we're digging in a little more to be able to understand those things better. Hmm. In terms of visual impairment, we have kinds of different visions. So some people will be completely blind and require a screen reader. Some people will be, you know, will have different forms of low vision. And so they need maybe a magnifier, or maybe a magnifier and screen reader combination. Some people, for example, have no peripheral vision, and some people have no central vision, where they only have peripheral vision. And that has an impact on how well they're able to visually see an interface and interact with it. So they might have a magnifier tool that increases the size of their screen to, say, 400%. So if somebody magnifies their screen by 400%, they're seeing roughly 1/16th of the screen at a time. And so think of the screen, look at the screen you're looking at now while we're talking, and envision like 1/16th of the screen actually taking up the entire thing. And you can see that, you know, there's actually some interesting things that might happen if that's the case. And so for people with low vision, we often see that multi-column layouts, or things that are way off to the right-hand side in a sidebar, for someone with low vision, they may not even, you know, they may not even exist, because they may not even know that it's there. So those are some of the kinds of things that we see. And there's really a lot to it. I mean, literally we could talk about each sort of, I don't even like saying type of disability or category of disabilities, but it's sort of a useful structure that people have used to group things. So
sure,
we could probably talk about each different type of disability pretty broadly for an hour each. Mm. I mean, there's so much to dig into. So
I believe it.
Some people are completely blind. Some people have low vision. Some people are completely deaf, or maybe just, you know, maybe hard of hearing, may have some hearing in one ear and no hearing at all in the other ear. And that makes dealing with stereo content difficult for them. And they have to change everything so that everything is converted to mono, so that it pipes it all through their one ear. Maybe they need sign language or captions for everything. And on the mobility and the dexterity side, there's lots of different things that we do in interfaces that make it a challenge for people with mobility or dexterity challenges to operate. So really tiny targets.
Right.
I feel this when I'm working on my phone. The little tiny targets are difficult for me to hit.
Yeah.
and multiply that by a factor of 20 or 25 and imagine what that might be like, or imagine what it's like for somebody to try and use a mouse when they've got an intention tremor. And so an intention tremor is when they're actually concentrating on something, their hand starts to shake. And so using a mouse can be quite difficult. They may need to rely on the keyboard for things. That's one of the, you know, one of the main reasons that we need to be able to use a keyboard for everything is that there's all kinds of people with different types of disabilities that require keyboard usage. Mm-hmm. So some people will be blind. They need to use a keyboard because they can't see the screen and they can't see the cursor to even know where the mouse is. So they have to operate everything by keyboard. There's lots of different scenarios out there where things like keyboard access become really, really important. And it becomes one of the most important things, I think, that we give advice to clients about is you need to make sure that you absolutely nail keyboard accessibility because it impacts all kinds of different groups of people.
Coming soon from Envision, the design collaboration platform used to create the digital products you love. Envision Studio, the world's most powerful screen design tool. Unlock new dimensions of screen design with Envision Studio's new adaptive layout engine, rapid prototyping, advanced animation, shared design systems, and other game-changing features created to help your team design better, faster, together. Clark from Envision says, "This is the design tool we've always wanted, and we're so excited to share it with you." Visit userdefenders.com/studio to get early access.
Yeah, I was thinking, first of all, I want to say God bless Apple for adding that motion feature, turning off the motion and the accessibility areas. I'm kind of hard on Apple sometimes, but I think it's just because we expect so much from them because they've done such amazing things. So I appreciate you putting that out there, Derek. That's amazing. And Apple's really,
yeah.
I think they've become really great champions at empathy for accessibility issues in adding features like this. And there's a whole probably undiscovered area in settings, right? That probably very few of us have gone and looked at, or maybe, you know, just some of us have, but I feel like that's a neat testament to Apple. So way to go, Apple, on that. And I was thinking about the vision aspects and man, navigating the web must have been hell for a lot of visually impaired people in the 90s. You remember how we were, a lot of it was small, light gray type. Remember that? That was really hard to adjust.
I do remember that. I'm actually sad to say that there's still way too much really tiny light gray type out there now. Mm. You know, we see it all the time. And you know, the funny thing is, and maybe it's not funny at all, but we think of things in an interface that people try to mute or kind of not draw attention to, but things that are required to be there, like legal terms and conditions.
Yeah.
Well, you put that legal terms and conditions in really tiny type and you put it in a lighter gray text so that you almost don't notice in the interface. What is that doing for people with low vision that are really going to struggle to see that? So they've got to actually do work.
Wow.
To even hunt for and find that text in the first place. And then, you know, many people with low vision will have tools that they can employ to transform that text and make it so that it's not light gray text on a slightly darker gray background. You know, they can apply tools to it to make that stuff stand out, but they need to even know that it's there in the first place. And that can often be one of the challenges. So,
yeah,
you know, there's a whole lot of it still going on out there. And there's even regulations in place in the healthcare industry that don't allow you to put legal terms and conditions in text that would be smaller than a certain size and would fail from a color contrast perspective for just that reason. We don't want to put terms and conditions in text that we know people that are aging just won't be able to read.
Yeah. Just because it makes the design look less sexy, right? Like that's a lot of our rationale, right? Let's be honest.
That's mostly our own ego and self-importance kind of coming through. And I say this as a person that has done that before. I'm not saying this without, I'm calling myself out here as well. Yeah.
Raising my hand too.
Yeah, exactly. Like are we really that, oh man, I'm going to say this. Are we really that precious? Like,
good point. I'm glad browser manufacturers too. I think browser manufacturers have stepped up a little bit here too for settings in browsers.
Yeah, definitely. And most browser vendors are at the point now where they're including a lot of readability tools with their browser by default, which is basically, it used to be like a browser extension. There was a readability browser extension.
Right.
Well, those things are now like getting built into browsers where you can just basically say, eliminate all the junk on this page and normalize it so that it's this color, this size text, and this color for the text. So put together a good base background and foreground color and let that ride. And you can turn that on and off with a switch. And I think that's pretty helpful. Particularly for cases where we have the sort of the unfortunate effect of people putting really low contrast text in their sites. And I'll have to say this too. While I'm happy that that tool is there, I hate that we have to rely on it because that whole readability thing that we do, we know about it because we're nerds.
Right.
You know, probably every single person that is listening to this podcast is way more nerdy than the average person. And
yeah.
I would bet that there's all kinds of people that need that kind of functionality that just don't even know that browser functionality is there.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right about that. So I'm going to play devil's advocate here, and I'm going to ask a question that may come off a little insensitive, but I am genuinely curious about this because I have a feeling that this is a scenario that is encountered more than once, I would imagine, in trying to design digital experiences. And Derek, and Defenders listening, I'm going to link to some of the talks that Derek's done. He's an incredible speaker, and he does a straw test, which is amazing. Like, it really helps increase your empathy for folks with, especially with visual impairments, where basically what he does is he says, make a straw. And then, you know, you put your hand in front of your eye and you close it and then you look at the screen and it literally puts yourself in the shoes of a visually impaired person on how they experience a lot of digital experiences. But I want to ask a question, and it's about designing for accessibility. And you've done some amazing things at Simply Accessible, now acquired by Level Access, which is awesome. Congrats, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, you guys have done some really interesting things, like even creating design patterns that really didn't exist. Like, I'm going to cite a couple examples before I ask my question. So I'm building this up. You guys have made, like, even icons. You've had to come up with unique icons for the column, which I thought was a brilliant solution for, again, the straw test for tables. And we do use a lot of tabular data on the web still, and we always will, I believe. So I love that idea about how you can actually select a cell and it'll bring the column and row headers right into context with that data. I thought that was brilliant. You had to come up with an icon to, as best you could, to describe what's going to happen when you click that. So there's a lot of things that you've done for this cause. And I want to ask you, have you encountered instances where designing for accessibility has made life better, perhaps for a smaller percentage of disabled users, but maybe worse or more confusing, for instance, with new design patterns, et cetera, for a larger percentage of more able, quote unquote, able users?
I would have to say no. And the reason for that is almost every single time that we have made an accessibility improvement in a design, it has almost always made it actually better for people without disabilities. There's this idea that people have said in many cases, accessibility is ugly, right? Or accessible sites tend to be uglier and we can't have our brilliant design. But I look at it and frame it in a completely different way. There's actually, you know, the need for accessibility and inclusion is just another design constraint that we need to work with in our designs. And it actually, in many ways, I think pushes us to be better designers. So we've seen, in fact, I've sat with world-class design teams that work for world-class agencies, and we've gone through accessibility improvements that they've needed to make in their designs. And I'm not talking about the dev side of things here. I'm strictly talking about the designs. And they have said to me after we've, you know, gone through most of a full day workshop on inclusive design. We've made all kinds of improvements, and they've said directly to me, Derek, this is good. Sure, these designs are all more accessible now, but each one of them is just a better design, period.
I love it.
And so I'm a big believer in the idea that when we design things intentionally to be more inclusive, we are making them better for everyone to begin with. And those cases where doing something in an accessible way has resulted in something that was more cluttered or was more difficult to use for people that weren't disabled, I would argue that those designs were actually more flawed from the beginning. Mm. And we were treating it like it was an add-on rather than something that was right there. So it's not, say, more difficult to use for people without disabilities because it's accessible. It's more difficult to use because we actually made it difficult to use for people with disabilities in the first place. Mm. And so we're compromising, or we're getting to the point where we're not doing things the way that we really should, you know, and building it into the design from the get-go. We're actually adding it on as an afterthought. And often when we're doing that, we're making compromises that we shouldn't really. And so we end up making it more difficult in the long run rather than being easier to use for everybody.
Yeah.
So there's very few cases that I have seen. And if you asked me to come up with one, I don't even think I could, where, you know, when we get to that point, I would say this, because we have gone down that road before where we've said, here's the things that we need to do to make this more accessible. What that has led to is people kind of pushing back and saying, well, if we do that, here's the effect of that. And now this design is harder to use, or it's more cluttered, or it's whatever, it's more ugly.
Sure.
That's the time to push back and say, then we need to start rethinking this and go back even further, because this feature, the way that it needs to be in order to be inclusive and to be accessible, we need to start rethinking that so that we can get to a design that actually works for everyone. So to me, it's more, when we get to that point, it's more cluttered or more ugly or less appealing because it just wasn't a great design in the first place.
Hi, I'm Nicole Blase. I'm a product designer at Xing, and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ugel.
So well said, Derek. And I love what you said in one of your talks too, and you just reiterated it. You know, a lot of what makes things more accessible is really just better design. So I love that. That's a wonderful and inspiring takeaway for all of us to consider and to contemplate. I know we're running short on time. I got a couple more I want to ask you.
Sure.
Can you tell us your most moving story of what you've witnessed personally as the biggest human-centered triumph just by designing for inclusivity and accessibility?
Yeah, I think actually very, very recent. We were doing usability testing with a client, and I still get goosebumps thinking about this moment. We're working with a client, wonderful client, startup in the Bay Area, and they had a lot of work ahead of them. They actually were facing, you know, they had a legal settlement and they needed to, they're very design centric. They knew they needed to do a bunch of technical things, but they really wanted to not have an impact on the design. And so we worked really hard with them over the course of a couple of years. And most of the work actually compressed into about a year. And they got to the point where they had fixed all the things that we had found in the representative testing session and assessment that we did. They fixed 473 issues that we found. They filed and fixed another 1,000 of their own, and they really embraced accessibility from the design phase and followed that through to execution. And when we were doing some usability testing at the end to verify and validate that, yes, this was what it needed to be, they actually had people with disabilities say, and I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking about it, they actually had people with disabilities that were using their service in the usability test say, this is awesome. Where can I sign up? Because I want to become a customer. And
oh, wow.
That moment was like probably like one of the best moments that I've ever experienced in my career. Just to hear that validation, but also to hear that people wanted to sign up for that service because of how accessible and how successful that client had become. That's a really special moment to me.
I've got goosebumps, Derek, myself. I'm actually a little choked up, but I think that that's just an incredible testament to the work. And that's just one story to the work that you've been doing for many years and championing. And I want to ask you, because I know our defenders listening, I just know it. They're also feeling the same way and they're feeling inspired and they want to even take, if it's baby steps, even if it's small steps toward working this into their design process, what's a roadmap you can offer to those of us who are just wanting to really go all in on learning how to do this stuff?
Yeah, I think the very best way, I mean, obviously there's good courses to get you started. And I know, you know, I'll throw in a little plug here on lynda.com. I've got a couple of very design centric accessibility courses that you can get to on lynda.com. One is called Foundations of UX Accessibility. And the other one is Accessibility for Web Design, really focused on the design side of things. So those are a great starting point. I would also say that the best way to understand designing for inclusivity is to actually start doing it and to incorporate people with disabilities into all the work that you do, even if it's just getting out of your office and going and talking and sitting with people with disabilities as they use things. Just try to understand that better. That takes you a tremendous distance in terms of being able to understand these people with different disabilities that I've been talking with. They are the same as me. They're trying to do the same things, but here's the tools that they use and some of the things that I can build into my design and to my development techniques so that they can have a much better experience working with this interface. And I can tell you tons of stories, but until people get out there and get outside of their normal routine of designing within their own heads or designing for people that are just like them, until we get out and start actually talking with people with disabilities and incorporating them into our process, we're not going to have that much significant change. So I think that's one of the best ways forward for people is to take one thing about your design process and figure out how to incorporate people with disabilities in it, whether that's near the beginning of the design process, the middle or the end. Anything that you do is more than what you're doing right now. Like, take one more step and incorporate something new. Even if you do something new every 2 weeks or every month, talk to one more person. That will change. I think that will change everything.
So good, Derek. Can you tell our defenders, who are no doubt inspired like I am, the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
Definitely. I'm Feather on Twitter. That is my preferred handle in as many places as I can get it. Twitter is, I'm Feather on Twitter. I'm Derek Featherstone on LinkedIn. That's another great place to connect. That's probably the best place. And I'm fairly active there. My DMs on Twitter are open too. So I'm happy to answer questions and chat with people and just kind of connect that way. So very happy to do that.
Derek, superheroes typically possess a strong moral code, including a willingness to risk one's own safety in the service of good without expectation of reward. You are a superhero, my friend. I want to close with this quote from Sir Tim Berners-Lee. I think I got this from you. I'm sure I did. The power of the web is in its universality. Access by everyone, regardless of disability, is an essential aspect. Derek, thank you for being a champion for many years and continuing on. And thanks for fighting for your users and fighting for all of us as well and helping us to learn more about this stuff. Just keep doing what you're doing, man. I really appreciate you. And I just want to say, last but not least, fight on, my friend.
Thank you. You know I will. And you too. Thanks so much for having me and letting me share with your listeners.
Need a hanky? I nearly did. I loved that story Derek told, and that's just one of many I'm sure he has to tell. I'm really stirred up to make sure that I consider everyone with anything I design. I know none of us are perfect and we're going to fail. It's nearly impossible to please everyone, but even just taking those small, important steps toward assuring and shoring up anything we can will make a bigger difference in designing for all. I'm so glad that I got to close the season out with this important episode, and I'm also so glad that Derek corrected my framing of disabled people not being any different from the abled. They just happen to have different challenges and tools to try and accomplish the same things that we are. And honestly, thinking about this, even us able-bodied probably have our own unique disabilities as well, perhaps ones that we may not even talk about openly. So we're all kind of disabled in a way, aren't we? And by the way, and yes, the transcript is actually available right now. This shows you the caliber of design superhero that Derek is. His only requirement for doing this interview was that the transcript be available at launch. Thanks, Derek, for your time and for pushing me in this accessible direction. I want to thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, consistently astonishing. Please be sure to check out his Etsy shop. It's at userdefenders.com/Eli. And support his valiant efforts as well. He's got some of his own astonishing prints in there that he sells to help keep his lights on. A couple of my favorites are his Pennywise the Clown and David Lynch works. Check it out and continue to encourage his behavior. I want to thank Envision for helping to keep this show's lights on by sponsoring this entire season. If you haven't already, be sure to check out their highly buzzworthy prototyping and animation tool, Studio, and get on their access list. I recently got my invite, and I can't wait to start beating this up. This has been an incredible season. I believe they keep getting better and better. I hope you do too. Thanks for being on this journey with me, Defenders. This is an absolute labor of love, and one I hope to keep going for a long time. There are times, to be honest, when I question whether or not I can keep fighting on in this, but then one of you will send me a tweet or an email or an iTunes review that will absolutely help make all of the hard work worth it. The one good thing about season breaks is it allows me more breathing room to try and get caught up on transcripts and even try to think of new products to add to the store. It's super hard to do anything like this in season, let alone balance out my family and professional development. But alas, I do want to keep fighting on for you. I would love to see at least 10 ratings and reviews come through during the off season. Would you do me that kindness, Defenders, and spare a few moments of your valuable time to leave one? It helps the show and other designers, as I mentioned earlier, to find it since I don't advertise. You can find it either by typing UX in the iTunes store or just go to userdefenders.com/review. Thanks so much in advance for your faithful support and enthusiasm for this show. You're why I do this. Please keep in touch with me during the off season, and please keep talking about the episodes and the show on Twitter. And feel free to get on the Biweekly Bugle to help keep tabs on what's happening with me and the show. I think I made up for the short episode time with this long outro, but I can't help it. It's hard to say goodbye for now. And thanks so much for fighting on for your users and for me, Defenders. And until next time, next season, fight on, my friends.